welcome. My name is Julian Schlossberg, and the name of our show is Movie Talk. John, on our last show, you mentioned your friendship with Barry Humphries, who played Dame Edna. I want to tell you a story, a quick one, that concerns Barry Humphries, Dame Edna, and Mike Nichols. Mike and I went to see Dame Edna. Unbelievable.
Which show?
The last show on Broadway. And we had a great time, and he knew him, so we went backstage. And we go backstage, and Barry comes out as Barry, not as Dame Edna, after we wait for a while. And Mike says, great, I loved it, and great to see you, Mike. And Mike says, I have one note. I wish I remember what the note was, but I have one note. And he says it to Barry. I wish I remembered it. But anyhow, Barry looks at him and says, no, she'd never do that.
Yeah, well, that's Barry.
There you go. Oh, so I figure if Mike Nichols comes with a joke, an idea, at least you want to. No, he didn't. He had no use for it.
Well, you have to trust. He really was a genius. I miss him. In fact, if I am blue or just want a joke, I'll go back on YouTube and just, he makes me laugh. He was wonderful. The New Yorker piece that I did with him, that became a book. I spent about 6 weeks on the road with him when he was touring and I would be standing next to the stage manager. It's the only comedy book I know written from backstage. And the thing that blew me away, we would be sitting there in his dressing room, and he'd be getting dressed as his alter ego, Sir Les Patterson. And he'd be putting the teeth in, and he had platform shoes, and he'd be putting all the red and dots on, and the dots and his red rouging up his cheeks. And the last thing he did is the other thing that was amazing is he would strap on what Dame Edna called his enormous incumbency, which was as long as, you know, like 5-6 feet, you know, he would tug during the performance. And then he would get all dressed up in his tuxedo. And then the last thing he would do when he went on stage was pick up this bottle of Worcestershire sauce and dribble it down the front of his tuxedo shirt. And he would go out on stage. And the reason he did that, this is what I loved about Barry, is it kept him in character. The smell kept him in character when he would get warm out there. And he would come out, and I tell you, I mean, if you stand in the wings, you can see people laugh. And it's very instructive because the audience he was playing to were like 2,500 people a night. And they all laugh like they would, it's like seaweed. They would rock like this and they would cover their mouths. And the reason he was calling out of them all the dark stuff, it was so liberating. And he would come out and Sir Les, this is where comedy gets lost in our culture, our Puritan culture. It's about terror and elation. The thrill, the sense of event that something is going to happen. And it's exciting, and you're kind of scared like you were a kid. And he comes out, and he comes out with a glass of scotch, you know, tugging his side of his pants. And he takes a drip, and he looks out in the audience and says, "Permit me." He's spitting on the audience. And then he turns around to the other, "Permit me if I may." And everybody is like tearing their hair, you know what I mean? And it's just wonderfully funny and elemental, Rabelaisian. Nobody is so daring and beautiful, and it's elegant in its own way. It's just the greatest evenings. I have to say, I have to be discounted for this because what I'm about to say, but besides seeing Dad, I've sat in the wings and watched people laugh so hard at Dad that they had to stuff a handkerchief in their mouth to stop laughing.
Yeah.
And Barry was equal to that. Barry could could do things that would just absolutely, I lost consciousness laughing. I can't account for like 3 or 4 seconds. I literally slipped out of my seat laughing at something that was so awful that he said, but he got away with it, you know? I mean, it was wonderful. I could go on forever talking about him. It was a great job.
I feel very privileged to have seen him twice and loved it every minute.
You know, when I went, I reviewed the show that you saw, and that was the show that Dame Edna was born again. And I've been born again. And I took the lady who was at the time was the other drama critic at the New Yorker, the second stringer, who'd never seen him. And I'm there taking notes of the act, and it always runs through the same thing. It's a formula, but he just changes it for each iteration of the show. And he was born again in this one. And he gets up there, and I'm taking my notes to write my review. And he comes to the part of the show where Dame Edna sings the song. And I'm sitting there writing, and the song goes, "Spin doctors have spun me. Dominic's done me. I'm even a book by John Lahr. Call me old-fashioned. I'm a born-again Broadway star." Well, Barry, the way Barry's Dadaist mind functions is he knew I would be in. He knew that this would blow my mind, and it did, and that I would never forget it, and I won't. It was just an amazing, amazing moment. And he would do that. He always said that all this stuff was for his own pleasure, and it was, you know, throwing gladiolas up into the belt. And getting adults to stand and wave these phallic symbols, and then him looking and saying, "There's nothing more holy than masked gladioli." You gotta love it.
You do. I want to jump back to your dad on a couple of things.
Sure.
One of the things I was struck with in thinking about your father was the fact that, unlike great movie stars of the time, many of them do not live. But your dad will always live because of The Cowardly Lion and Oz.
It's such a blessing.
And as long as people study American theater, Broadway, Waiting for Godot, the man who co-starred on Broadway, the original, was your dad. It's amazing that in those two arenas, he will live forever.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, as long as people know who Beckett is, that's a bit of a stretch these days.
Yeah, but it is these days. On the other hand, if you care about theater, you have to know who Beckett is. That's
exactly
right.
And it's great that
he has that.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Really wonderful.
So let's talk about his unhappiness at 20th Century Fox. They really didn't know what to do with him, did they, John?
Well, they didn't, but then they didn't know what to do with great clowns at all. Look what they did with Keaton. Keaton lost it at the movies. They couldn't deal with his humor. Because sound, you know, Dad was essentially, his kind of comedy was too broad, too loud for, his quality could only really be captured as an animal, as a lion, where he could be larger than life. When you see him in the other movies that he did, it's not wonderful. His essence doesn't come through in the way that it does in the clown, in the animal disguise. And as he famously said, he left in 19, he built a house out there. He was hoping to work in the movies, but, he left saying, "How many lion parts are there?" And, you know, most of the people who went west, the comedians who went west, didn't have a public on Broadway. Dad had a Broadway, not just a pedigree, but he had a following. So he could go back, and he left to perform on Broadway with Ethel Merman in a Cole Porter musical. Come on.
That's right.
As opposed to being in, you know, second banana to some romance in Hollywood. And I think he made the right, he chose his art. He chose the stage, which in another sense, I mean, all the great performing that he did isn't remembered in the same way because it's not preserved. On the other hand, when I was interviewing for that book, Jimmy Cagney, who was a friend of Dad's out there, I said, you know, be lucky for you, you have all those movies. And he said, lucky? You know, all those bad performances preserved forever? Do you know what I mean? I mean, it can cut both ways, you know.
Well, I was interested in his friendship with Buster Keaton, and you wrote that he admired the way Keaton could handle what happened to him more than your dad felt he could.
Well, you know, Dad had a much, he didn't have the kind of influential career, ultimately, that we now think of Keaton having had. I mean, the films now have a stature which, at the time we were growing up, they didn't have.
That's right.
But Dad could work longer, and they did a movie together, which is how come I know Keaton, because I carried his ukulele to the train. They went up to Canada to make a movie starring Frankie Avalon, if you can imagine. That's a change, isn't it?
Oh, my.
And they never made it because the producers couldn't find the money, and they started the film. They couldn't complete it. But yeah, they were friendly, and there's a sort of, what's the word? I want to use the word, it's not the right word, but there's a sort of heroism, there's a gallantry, I suppose, in these old timers. The industry had changed so much, and they, you know, people with half the talent were making three times as much money as they were. They were, and their influence was, I'm just writing about this. The low comedians of the first half of the century were the influence on the next generation's high art. If you talk about Artaud or the Theater of Cruelty, who was the avatar of Theater of Cruelty? Groucho Marx. And Meyerhold, the famous Russian director, who was the avatar of the kinetic theater that he was building? Charlie Chaplin. And Beckett, who were the people that really gave, that Beckett was deconstructing? He was deconstructing Keaton and Laurel and Hardy. And, you know, there Keaton made a film called that Beckett wrote. And Dad, the really great performers of Beckett's are these bewildered, lost souls that become, or I was thinking of Max Wall here in England. I can't really go to any modern production, like Keanu Reeves playing Estragon or something. Come on. These people are, those characters are bewildered and ignorant and lost. And in a way, they are the real messengers of Beckett's comedy, tragic comedy. They incarnate it in their own suffering and humor that come together in them, you know.
Well, let's talk in terms of, was there anybody who you really wanted to profile that you couldn't get?
Well, I'll give you two quick ones. Not everybody wants a profile. Mel Brooks, who had once been profiled by Tynan after The Producers was such a mega hit, they wanted another profile. So I got in touch with Mel, and he called me, and he literally said, John, I love what you do. I just don't want you doing it to me. and the more serious one was Meryl Streep wrote me a three-page letter explaining essentially what she wanted. She didn't want the audience. She didn't want anything between the audience's perception of the character in whatever film she was doing to be anything to intrude on the performance that she was giving, any biographical elements to improve to at all. She wanted the she wanted to disappear, as it were, into the character and having no other, nothing between the character and the story she was telling in any way. And, you know, fair enough. I mean, if I have said in the pitch, you know, don't do this because it takes time and a certain commitment. It'll be a waste of your time and a waste of mine as well. I've had a couple of people that when I got into the weeds with them, turned out to be, well, only one really that was bad, but really bad was Sean Penn. Sean Penn was a real swine in every way, in the sense of how he treated people, how he treated me, a certain kind of, you know, people who are arrogant are actually really stupid. I mean, the stupidity of arrogance is an essay, but he was, and I got a good. I think it's included in.
It definitely is, and
you wouldn't know I had that.
I was just going to say that does not come across.
No, not at all. But it was. I wouldn't do that because he is a very fine actor, I understand to a large extent. There, if you read closely between the lines, you can see a certain kind of animus of mine.
Well, what I felt was you had to be on edge with him.
Yeah,
that's absolutely. Not out of it. But I got the feeling, John, that at times with Sean Penn, you were on edge. That I did feel.
Yeah, he makes you on edge. And also, I probably was reining in a certain amount. I just think, you know, come on, man. Stop.
On the other hand, I have admiration for his ability to go into areas where most correspondents won't go, into Iran and Iraq and Katrina and Watts. I mean, Haiti. I mean, he really goes in there as a correspondent trying, yeah. It appears, to help people.
Yeah. I guess I don't give him, I don't quite know what that's about. But I was in a situation where he was showing me what he was writing. And from where it was terrible what he was writing. I mean, the content might've been great. It was just badly written. And it puts you in. He puts you in very strange situations. He took me to a bar. He pointed to the ceiling. There was a hole in the ceiling. He put a bullet through there. He shot a gun in the ceiling, and he said, "I'll meet you at 6 at some bar." And I went. I stayed there at 7 o'clock. He hadn't shown up, and I said, "Has Sean been around?" And he said, "We were supposed to go to dinner," and I think this is in the piece.
That's in the book.
Yeah, and then he. He went to dinner with somebody else and came. He just kept me hanging. And, you know, the one I don't like is the disrespect. In other words, it's a two-way street. And he just behaved very badly. You know, it's not, I would never stop a profile, but I didn't like being treated. It was sort of sadistic.
Did you ever get to a point where you did want, you never got to, putting Sean Penn aside, which obviously you're able to do, what I wanted to ask, well, did you ever start one and say, no, this is not going to work? I don't care who it was.
I got a very good result, and it ended very well. But one of the, this is part of the agreement. They know going in that there'll be a little, there'll be an element of psychological inquiry. So, I'm a great fan, of David Mamet's. I love especially his early work. And we started out and we got to talking about, I wanted to ask him some questions about his father. And he said, no, I'm not going to. And I said, but David, we agreed that this was, and I had to turn off the, I did turn off the tape recorder and say, David, we can't go on if you're not going to answer these questions. And what he did was, I mean, the issue between him and his father is a big deal, because when his father died, David, at the cemetery, you know, you everybody has a shovel. Everybody takes a shovel and shovels a little dirt on the grave. David didn't let anybody who came to the graveside throw any dirt on this. He buried his father himself. He shoveled all the dirt on his father's. He had a big issue with his father. And the way that we got around that particular hurdle was his sister talked about the father so that I could get some. And in the end, he responded so positively to the profile that when I got back to my office after it had run, I got a package from him. I had been at his writing cabin in Vermont, and I had admired a pike that had been painted on a shingle, and because I love to fish, and he had sent me, and it's downstairs in my conservatory, on an 18th century shingle. That guy who painted the pike painted two trout. It was just the most generous way of saying, you know, essentially, sorry, I was a jerk, and yeah, I like what you did. You know what I mean? But it was classy, and I appreciated it.
I was able to get from him recently about the Judeo-Christian ethic that he followed from his father, who would work day and night, had worked for, I think, clerked for one of the great Supreme Court justices. So he was able to talk about that, but we didn't go into anything beyond the fact that he emulated in all his writings, because he's written almost as much as you, or vice versa.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I'm interested in talking about not only the 13 profiles in Razzle Dazzleum, but Petrified. Now, that's a very interesting story. Would you elaborate on that?
Petrified is about being, you know, it's about stage fright and what that psychologically really is, and the enormous number of actors and performers who face it and deal with it in different ways. It starts with Stephen Fry actually just walking off stage and wanting, almost killing himself because of stage fright, and then goes into a psychological study of what it really is about. And what you don't is about losing the idea of coherence, the whole idea of rehearsing for 2 months is to see, to create the illusion of effortlessness. Once you lose that confidence in yourself, you feel exposed. And once you feel exposed, you feel humiliated. And it's that kind of fear of, what's the word I'm looking for? Of the absence of prowess that collapses people. And the piece is interesting because it was chosen as one of the best essays of the Harcourt Brace best essays when it came out. And, you know, it interested me because it's an area that actors don't like to talk about it. And it just doesn't get discussed much. And that piece surprised me that it seemed to, that's why I wanted to include it in the book, because it turned out to be one that the response was much bigger than I didn't think, like the essay, but I just didn't realize that it touched a nerve. It originally started, it was cut, unfortunately, but once my sister, who went, was in the Three Little Bears, in her little ballet class when she was about 5 or 6, and Dad, who never usually came to any events with us, very rare, I think he saw me play football once, came to one basketball game, and that was it. That was his entire attendance. But anyway, he was in the audience, and Jane came out for some reason. She came out and got completely confused with the blocking and everything. And she came, she came downstage and looked down at Dad and went, like, I'm lost. I don't know what to do. Anyway, it was so charming, but we had to cut her. She was on the cutting room floor, unfortunately. But anyway,
that kind of inspired you to do the piece. It sounds
It was how, and that was the lead. You know, the point is that you asked me about it, and I haven't read it in a while, so my explanation is not as specific.
Oh, it's a terrific piece, and I was so surprised that.
Well, that's why it ends the book, because all of these people, one way or another, are dealing with the masquerade and what the masquerade of perfection is. You know.
And that sword hanging over their head often.
Yeah, always. And it's an exhibition of aplomb. I mean, if the minute there's a crack in the aplomb, the whole fabric of control and image, which, you know, we all do it in writing. You work forever to make things, I mean, really hard and long to make things seem effortless. And they also get edited. Do you know what I mean? So the persona under all any writer, it's like you're sending out an alter ego. It's your avatar. And you're always, you know, looking good. It's like my editor and I call it shampoo and blow dry. You know, you go out looking your absolute best, but boy, you can really.
They didn't see you in the morning. I wanted to say to you that I know your dad co-starred with Ethel Merman in Du Barry Was a Lady, and they asked her. They said, "Miss Merman, Olivia is petrified on opening night, and Helen Hayes throws up. How are you?" And she said, "Are you kidding? If they could do what I could do, they'd be up here doing it."
That sounds right. We have Jane and I, but Jane has the picture. There's a wonderful picture of Dad in Du Barry Was a Lady, with Dad in his finery Merman in dressed as you know, Madame de Pompadour, whoever she's playing, and she's flipping Dad off. She's giving him the finger. And you know, my favorite Merman thing is call me Miss Birdseye. The show is frozen.
Yes, that's right. I have a couple of others to tell you off the air.
Oh, I see.
I want to ask you, as a theater critic, are you writing for the New Yorker audience, or are you writing for John Lahr?
Oh, I'm absolutely writing for the people on the stage. I'm trying to convey to the reader, most of whom won't see the play, what it felt like to be there and what it looked like and what's going on. But in the way of telling that, I'm trying to interpret it. I look at each play, serious play, as a metaphor. And a metaphor, therefore, is there to be interpreted. And usually, although this may sound strange to people who aren't writers, I mean, the writer doesn't necessarily know what the meaning of the thing he's done or she's done is. I mean, they have something they want to say, but there's more in it in its complication. I don't think Pinter, for instance, or Beckett. It's a sort of emotional experience that has many, many threads, many suggested ideas, and underneath it. And you're there to sort of winkle them out and cast a spotlight on them and to tell them from your point of view what it meant to you. But in doing that, you're really painting, you're risking interpretation. But what I'm not doing is telling an audience whether they should invest in a ticket to go. You know, the journalistic thing is if you're writing for a newspaper, is that you're there to report what happened. This opened. This is what it said. This is the story. But, you know, the story, the plot, isn't the play. The plot is just an excuse for the author to hang his perceptions or her perceptions on. So that's in my mind, that's what I'm doing.
I asked Mike Nichols once the difference between plot and story, and he was
a question.
And he was very succinct. He said, plot is the king is dead, the queen is dead. He said, story is the king is dead, the queen is dead of a broken heart.
That's funny. That's really good.
Isn't that something? Yeah.
Very, very good.
And I want to keep talking, but I know enough is enough to you. I appreciate it.
I knew it would be fun, Julian.
I did too, John. I wanted to ask my last question, and that is this. In looking over your career as a writer and all the things you've done, what would you say were one or two of the biggest highlights, the ones that you really meant the most, you think, to you?
That's a hard question.
I have a smart man. I'm talking to a smart man.
No, I don't really. I suppose I'd have to say where my biography of Tennessee Williams is the one that I feel was the most mature. The book on Barry gave me the most joy. And also, this is actually a sad autobiographical thing, but I had two children that died. They died at birth, and I had to go out and do the Humphrey story and travel with him. And he one of his jokes is that Dame Edna can heal. And he actually, being with him and experiencing the joy that he could make, but also the miraculousness of humor in some way, the way it can not just lift the spirits, but liberate you in some way. I found that being lifted of the gravity of my situation was something that was a real blessing. So that little book, which I wrote very quickly, means a lot to me. But the book on Williams, you know, I wrote that when I was 73 years old. And, you know, a lot of my friends who are writers, you know, it feels like it's the last of the ninth and you're up there and it's, you know, they're two, you know, it's a 3-2 count and here comes the ball. And for me, it took 12 years to write that book and it was a walk-off home run. You know, I felt I wrote well. I had an amazing, in Williams, an amazingly complicated and interesting story that touched on all aspects of America and all the great actresses and directors, that's Kazan especially, that he worked with. So there was a very large tapestry to investigate. And there's a lot of luck in it. There was, as you have to have if you're a biographer, you don't always get the, you know, I know nobody else could have gotten Audrey Wood's correspondence those kind of things that hold a book together that are really the sort of backbone of it.
And even though you've received, I would say I've counted over 20 major awards, the most awards are from that book.
Yeah. And I put more into it in the sense of, I didn't know, 73, I'm Jewish, what are you gonna do? we keep joking about it, but, because it was also nobody had tried to make Williams was avowedly the most autobiographical of American playwrights, although people who claim not to be autobiographical, like Arthur Miller, are actually rather autobiographical. But Williams actually said that he wrote the plays. The plays were sort of a map of his internal life at the time of the writing. So nobody had thought to actually take him at his word and try to meld his life and the plays and what was going on at the time of the writing, which I did. And it took a long time, but at the time I was writing, there were already 40 books on him, but they didn't do that, either because they didn't have the knowledge or the time or whatever. So I felt that it was the culmination of all I'd learned in terms of writing, but also that all the things that I'd done at the New Yorker, because I had the benefit of for 20 years of these really great writers that really could help me to write better and tell stories better, and still do. I mean, you make a lot of mistakes, but it was the best I could do in a lifetime of trying. It's like a platonic thing. You're always trying to hit that note. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Well, I thank you, John Locke, for our time together. Yeah.
Thanks for joining us on Julian Schlossberg's Movie Talk. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.